What's your favorite drink? For me, it's probably a Negroni, but maybe swap out the gin for some tequila. I think it's the perfect medley of flavors. You get that earthy, savory bite of agave, the bitterness of the Campari, the sweet touch of the vermouth. It's chilled but not icy. And like any good cocktail, like whatever your favorite drink might be, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. I mean, on their own, each of those things is fine, but nobody's drinking Campari straight out of a bottle. When you put them all together, they're much more appealing. They balance each other. They work well. And you might say the same thing about making policy, even bad policy. Effective protectionism is kind of like a cocktail. I'm Eric Boehm, and you're listening to a Reason Magazine podcast series about how the free market wants to deliver the goods for consumers and how government keeps getting in the way. Over the past 3 weeks, we've highlighted how protectionism harms everyone by driving up prices and limiting the availability of critical goods, from baby formula to sneakers. But we haven't talked as much about how those anti-competitive rules get made in the first place, or why they can be so difficult to undo. So today we're mixing up a cocktail that's one part democracy, two parts protectionism, adding a dash of low-level cronyism. Shake well and garnish with a slice of moral authority, and the result is a tidy theory for why we can't have nice things. This is episode 4, Bootleggers, Baptists, and Ballots.
So here, I have no idea what town we're in. Somewhere in Arkansas, Elevated Spirits.
We're gonna stop at 8 different liquor stores all throughout Arkansas.
Oh, the holiday celebrations are upon us, and for a lot of people, that means sharing a cocktail. What do Arkansas laws say about that?
If you want to get something done in politics, it helps to have two things.
You need an argument for why this is good for society. That's important. But you also need money.
That's Jeremy Horpital.
And I am an associate professor of economics at the University of Central Arkansas. I'm also the director of the Arkansas Center for Research in Economics.
Horpital's research leans into something known as public choice theory that basically tries to apply economic reasoning to explain how political decisions get made. It starts with the assumption that everyone involved in politics is self-interested. But that doesn't mean everyone is working alone.
It's very hard to do things in politics without money. And often the group that is making the moral argument, whatever it might be, religious or environmental or whatever the moral argument is, they don't often have a lot of financial resources. They might be trying to raise donations for this issue, but who has financial resources? It's businesses and businesses who stand to lose if the laws are changed. If current laws benefit a business, they stand to lose a lot of money if the laws are changed. And they're willing to expend a lot of resources to keep the status quo.
Within the field of public choice economics, there's a famous shorthand for this arrangement, the bootleggers and the Baptists.
Bootleggers and Baptists is a model for understanding political coalitions developed by Bruce Yandel. And in this model, he presents the idea that you would have two parties to a coalition, one that's interested in the financial part of it and making money. This would usually be a business of some sort. And then the other part of the coalition, which he called the Baptist, would be a organization that has some sort of moral argument for something.
In short,
they either think this is the right thing to do, or they think this is a way for us to make a buck.
In Yandel's original article, he outlined how these two special interests that otherwise have very little in common might work together to limit when or where alcohol could be sold.
The story was about how, you know, both churches and bootleggers might favor Sunday closing laws, right, where you couldn't sell alcohol on Sundays. The bootleggers like it because they can sell things that day of the week. And the Baptists like it because that day is reserved as the day for the Lord, the day to spend with family.
If you want a less theoretical example for how this sort of thing might work, then Horpital's home state of Arkansas is a perfect example.
We're a state that has long restricted alcohol sales.
Arkansas might have the weirdest alcohol rules in the country, or at least the most politically contentious. Prohibition ended 90 years ago, but there are still dozens of counties in Arkansas that ban the sale of alcohol.
Yeah, so what a dry county means in Arkansas is no retail sales for off sale. Some, like the city I'm in, Conway, Arkansas, a city of close to 70,000 people, we actually have 50 places, 50, 5-0, that you can go and get a drink at the restaurant. So with your meal, you can have a drink, but you cannot, say, purchase a bottle of wine there to take home. That is not allowed. So there's no retail stores. That also means for the bars and restaurants that can serve it, they don't have distributors coming into the county. They have to drive to another county themselves to purchase it.
And here's the kicker. The number of dry counties in Arkansas is so high, in part because of the political influence of liquor stores, the retail outlets that are literally in the business of selling booze.
Right. The big dynamic that the current rules in Arkansas have set up is that the liquor stores and other retailers that are located in wet counties, especially those located close to a border, are going to have a strong interest in keeping the status quo. Many of them have set up right at the border to between wet and dry counties, and they have a strong interest in being able to keep selling there.
For those county line liquor stores, the ongoing existence of a neighboring dry county isn't just about less competition. Horpital says it could also be a matter of life and death.
If they were to lose that privilege of selling right at the border, and we could have, you know, liquor stores set up right in this county or grocery stores selling beer in the county, there's no real good economic reason for that store to be located where it is. There's no sustainable reason for them to be there other than the current structure of the laws.
And there's yet another weird thing about Arkansas's liquor laws. They're often subject to public referendums. Unlike in most other states, Arkansas allows residents of counties to decide via ballot measure whether they'd like to allow or ban the sale of booze. You probably thought that we settled that debate in America with the passage of the 21st Amendment, but in Arkansas, it's a fight that keeps happening over and over again. For our purposes, that's helpful because it makes it harder for the special interests to operate in the shadows. For an award-winning paper that he published in 2021, Horpital looked through the campaign finance reports for dozens of county-level liquor legalization elections in recent Arkansas history. He found that one of the biggest financiers on the pro-liquor side of those fights has been Walmart. That's probably not much of a surprise. It's the world's biggest retailer, and it also happens to be based in Arkansas, in Bentonville, near where Sam Walton opened the first store in 1962.
And the ones that are supporting legalization are generally going to be retail businesses that could sell beer and wine if it were legalized. So Walmart, gas stations, they're going to be the ones supporting this. So Walmart is trying to make it legal, spending something like $400,000 in a county that's got maybe 100,000 or fewer people. And the spending on the other side is never quite as large as Walmart, but spending $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 by just a couple of liquor stores is not unusual.
There aren't many situations where Walmart is an underdog these days, especially not on the store's home turf. But the liquor stores in Arkansas have an ace up their sleeve.
But the special interests here are not only the county line liquor stores, but of course, there are also churches who have long been either in favor of prohibition or just in favor of high regulation on alcohol. And they are part of the political dynamic as well.
Remember what we said at the beginning about the combination of money and morality in politics, the bootleggers and the Baptists. In this case, the bootleggers are the liquor stores, and the Baptists, well, are often actual Baptists.
The churches will serve a number of roles in this coalition. One of them is serving as kind of public relations, and that would be, if the local newspaper or TV station wants to do a story about it, they'll look through these campaign finance records, as I have too, and they might identify the groups that have given money, big money, but a lot of times they don't want to talk about it. The liquor stores don't want to say, yeah, we're just in it for our own interests. So they'll often defer to the churches and say, talk to them.
This is a potent 1-2 punch.
Because Arkansas is a very religious state, they can talk to their congregation to get them to either tell them don't sign it or, convince your neighbors not to sign it. So they'll send out regular newsletters, social media posts, telling people, here are the steps you can take to prevent the demon alcohol from coming to our county. So that is, I think, the kind of major roles that the church would serve in this is being I don't want to say the moral cover, because like they are sincere in their belief here, right? They're not just a cover for the liquor stores. They truly do believe this and are sincere in their beliefs that it's good for society what they're doing. But the group that they are implicitly partnering with is a group that sells the thing they're trying to prohibit. So it's a very kind of interesting dynamic there.
Later on, we'll take a closer look at how those elections play out, Even though it's probably a bit more explicit in Arkansas than it is anywhere else, this combination of competitive interests and appeals to moral authority show up over and over again within America's heavily regulated alcohol markets. In fact, it's kind of baked directly into the way that most states regulate booze.
There are long-standing blue laws that really prohibit distilled spirits to be able to compete fairly in the marketplace.
That's Chris Swanger, who probably knows more about America's strange patchwork of alcohol laws than almost anyone else.
I'm the president and CEO of the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States. And Discus is experiencing our 50th year anniversary, and we're really the leading trade association on behalf of the U.S. distilled spirits industry.
To understand how political dynamics like the one in Arkansas can become so powerful, Swanger says you first have to understand the basic structure of how alcohol gets from a distillery to your liquor cabinet.
The beverage alcohol industry is governed by what's called the three-tier system, where the product goes from supplier to distributor to the retailer, on and off-premise retailer. And the three-tier system is great because it ensures taxes are properly paid. You can track and monitor the product. Like all beverage alcohol should be regulated in some form just to make sure that the product is only accessed by legal drinking age consumers and the taxes are paid and all of that.
Each level in that system contains businesses that are self-interested. And just like the county line liquor stores in Arkansas, they fiercely defend their turf.
I'll give you a wacky law in the great state of Texas. The last 15, 20 years, you know, you've got all these beautiful Texas distilleries popping up, and there is a state law that prevents them to selling more than two bottles to a consumer within a month. Texas bourbon, prime time, right? Fall in love with the product, and you want to say, I want to get my older brother one. I want to get my mom and dad one for their anniversary. You can't do that. You got a two-bottle limit. Two-bottle limit.
But why?
Our lovely Texas retailer friends want all the traffic to come into their stores, right? So that's just a wacky law that we're trying to overcome, and it's just the forces of competitive interest.
It's not just the forces of competitive interest, of course. It's the forces of competitive interest pulling the levers of state government. Those Texas liquor stores want the state to limit how much whiskey a distillery can sell for the exact same reason that the Arkansas liquor stores want to keep certain counties in the state dry. They want less competition. That's obviously bad for consumers, but it's tough for the distilleries too, because new brands have a hard time breaking into the three-tier system.
Distributors are naturally inspired to be able to distribute products that are high in volume, right? Because that's where the economics come into play. Sometimes it's not as economically palatable to put a lot of time and effort in products that are yet known, right?
One possible solution is to let distilleries just bypass the system entirely. A lot of wineries can already do that.
You can direct-to-consumer ship wine in 47 states. You can only direct-to-consumer ship distilled spirits in 11 states. So what Discus is doing is advocating, trying to overcome some of the political forces at play that are really doing this for their own competitive interest, to make sure when a consumer visits a beautiful distillery, whether it's in California or Texas or Florida or wherever, if that consumer goes, 6 hours away and they can't access that product at their local retail outlet, or if they go across state lines, they can order it online and they can have that bottle shipped to them directly.
That is, once again, a political process. It's state lawmakers and alcohol regulators deciding who can buy what and where and in what amounts. In many cases, they've defaulted to protectionist schemes that favor the status quo, even as the rest of the alcohol market has been shifting and evolving. Consumers now have greater choice than ever, and there are more distilleries, more wineries, more breweries than ever before. But the three-tiered system still represents a choke point.
Consumers today, and I think this applies across the board, consumers today want to expect and are able to purchase products online. the world has changed dramatically. Increased consumer demand for convenience was accelerated by the pandemic. And it's driving this force, this driving force is intensified for calls to direct-to-consumer shipping. And, you know, this includes the desire for consumers to obtain limited release products, right? Some of the larger distilleries that have great distribution access and so forth like to bring products to market and would like to be able to direct ship that special bottle that you can't access anywhere.
Just rolling into Jonesboro, Arkansas. And when I rolled into this town, I was worried. I was scared. I was nervous. I was petrified. I was horrified. You know why? Because I found out that this is a dry county. That's right. That's what I said. You know what? Do you think it's funny? You think it's funny when Stone Cold Steve Austin rolls into a dry county? What?
Back in Arkansas, the elections that determine which counties are wet and which are dry can get pretty contentious. But because the ballot access threshold is so high, Horpital says the elections themselves aren't really the focal point. It's actually all about getting the issue on the ballot in the first place.
But that means the real political battle and legal battle is at the stage of trying to get it on the ballot in the first place and trying to collect enough signatures that are seen as legally valid.
This should sound familiar to anyone who's ever supported a third party or independent candidate. Getting on the ballot is often more than half the battle. Now, these ballot access laws differ from state to state, but third party candidates generally have to meet a higher threshold than Republicans and Democrats do, which is no surprise because Republicans and Democrats wrote those laws. The same is true with Arkansas's liquor elections. The state legislature has actually changed the threshold several times since the end of Prohibition. The most recent change in the 1990s now requires that 38% of the registered voters in a county must sign a petition just to put the issue on the ballot.
Once it gets on the ballot in all the counties that have happened since 2006, it passes. Voters pass it. Once you have collected signatures equal to at least 38% of the registered voters, you've got pretty good support that's going to pass anyway.
Within the context of these campaigns, how does this coalition of liquor stores and churches actually work?
You know, especially powerful about this coalition is that you have the liquor stores, which can provide the money to prevent legalization of alcohol sales, and the churches, which can provide the moral argument, the public face of the campaign to keep these things, keep the rules how they are, or to prevent enough signatures from being collected to get on the ballot.
In practice, that means hiring lawyers, lots of them, to pore over the petitions of voters who say they want to put this question on the ballot.
In Arkansas, you know, you do this on paper, right? I don't know if any state where it's electronic. It's on paper, right? And so you either the people that want to do it go out themselves, or you can hire people to do it. You can pay people to collect signatures. But typically, you're going to have a piece of paper that states, what is this for? And it's going to have 20 lines on it. And you have people sign on those lines and they fill out, you know, their information. They fill out, you know, their address, what county they live in, and so on and so forth. And you're going to have 20 signatures on the page, is typical in Arkansas and other states.
Under Arkansas law, if even a single signature on a page is from someone who lives in a different county, the whole page of signatures can be ruled invalid.
So they can throw out an entire page of 20 signatures if one of the signatures on that was not valid. That's the main way of blocking these and where most of the money is spent.
Now, we've covered a lot of ground today. And you might be wondering, hey, I thought this was a podcast about trade policy, not about alcohol laws and election procedures. And sure, this isn't a story about trade policy, at least not in the same way that tariffs or the Jones Act might be, but this is fundamentally a story about trade, about the ways that limiting where goods can be sold or how they move across borders creates political dynamics that can be exploited by self-interested parties. And once those political dynamics are created, they can be very difficult to undo. A border doesn't have to be a line on the ground dividing one country from another. It can also be the line between a wet county and a dry county in Arkansas. It can be the distinction that exists between the distributor level and the retail level of the three-tiered system. Goods have to cross all of those borders, And a combination of self-serving special interests and poorly written government policies make that process cumbersome, expensive, and sometimes impossible. And then, when you layer moral arguments on top of everything else, it only gets worse.
You know, with this connotation, there's hard liquor and then there's beer and wine. Well, that's a bad way to look at it because you need to know what you're drinking. And alcohol is alcohol. And it's really, you know, the practice of moderation and how you consume the product. So if you're able to access beer and wine at a particular outlet, you should be able to access distilled spirits as well. Alcohol is alcohol. An ounce and a half of distilled spirits is the same amount of alcohol as 5 ounces of wine, which is a standard serving, and a 12-ounce beer. And that is all recognized and qualified by the U.S. dietary guidelines. So, you know, the distilled spirits industry has been trying to overcome these negative connotations about our great products. And some of it, to be honest with you, has been invoked by competitive interests.
Whether driven by the prohibitionist moral impulses or the economic interests of the beer and wine industry, the results here are pretty clear. Consumers that want to choose whiskey or gin over beer or wine are often forced to jump through extra hoops. Sometimes they have to go to a special store or pay higher taxes. Often they can't get their drink of choice shipped directly to their home. Sometimes it means that a liquor-based drink with the same amount of alcohol as a beer gets discriminated against.
4 or 5 years ago, it was all about White Claw, which is a great brand. It's a malt-based brand, right? But now you've got spirits-based ready-to-drink products with the same exact amount of alcohol. Same exact amount of alcohol. Typically, 5% ABV, alcohol by volume, right?
These days, distilleries and other spirit producers are making pre-mixed cocktails, things like margaritas in a can. They don't have any more alcohol in them by volume than a strong beer might, but they're still subject to the state laws that govern liquor, which are more strict, typically, than those regulating beer and wine.
And in Texas, you can't go to a convenience store and buy a ready-to-drink or a cocktail in a can at a convenience store or at a grocery store. Why? Because those products, because they're spirits-based, even though it's got the same amount of alcohol as some of the well-known beer brands or flavored malt beverage brands, we'll get all kinds of cockamamie arguments like it's going to violate social responsibility standards, or in the medieval times, beer was recognized as a food and distilled spirits was recognized as a narcotic.
The mixture of moralizing religious authority and economic self-interest is a pretty common formula for protectionism. It's all still the Baptists and the bootleggers, just dressed up in different forms.
It's not a formal model, but you might think of it as a framework for thinking about how coalitions form when you have these two interests, which in many cases might have nothing else in common. In some cases might actually be opposed to each other on a lot of issues. But they have a common interest on this one issue. And because they can do those two important things for politics, they're often a very effective coalition.
Money and morals, the two things you need to get stuff done in politics. But it's not an undefeatable combination. It's been slow going, but Horpital says that the trend in Arkansas has been towards greater economic freedom for booze.
There have been small communities that have said, and even after a few liquor stores had set up, said, no, we don't want this. And so we're gonna hold our own election in our city. A few cities have done that and gone the opposite direction. But as far as this part of it, the direction has been towards legalization. And it's been towards the direction of liberalization overall on alcohol use in Arkansas in the past few decades.
For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm, and I'll drink to that.
More specifically, vodka, whiskey, beer, tequila, more beer, more vodka, more whiskey.
You've been listening to episode 4 of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, a 6-part Reason podcast series about how the free market wants to deliver the goods for consumers and how government keeps getting in the way. Next week, we'll turn back to a more conventional tale about restrictions on international trade. It's a story about a trade war that happened half a century ago when some European governments got mad about American exports of frozen chicken. And so that's why pickup trucks today are so much more expensive than cars. Sounds crazy, right? Tune in next week to find out why. This week's episode was written by Eric Boehm and produced by Hunt Beatty. Audio mixing by Ian Kaiser, fact-checking by Catherine Seifer, and our executive editor is Jim Epstein. Special thanks to this week's guests, Chris Swanger and Jeremy Horpadal. For more about this topic, check out Horpadal's paper, Bootleggers, Baptists, and Ballots, Coalitions in Arkansas Alcohol Legalization Elections, published in the journal Public Choice. Or find his piece in Regulation Magazine. Not So Unlikely Coalitions is the headline. Bootleggers and Baptists are alive and well in Arkansas.